Blog Talk Radio.
Yo, check this out. Chuck, the public enemy.
Yo, what's up? This is DJ Yella from the world's most dangerous group.
What's up? This is DOC, the Diggy Diggy motherfucking God.
Yo, what's up? This is your boy, Z-Man.
What up, dog? This is Keisha.
This is Jerry Heller, motherfucker.
It's your boy, DJ Paul KOL from 36 Block.
Young Busy Bone.
Vice Warp.
This your man, Mastermind of Hell, Raise Up.
Yo, this is DJ Ready Red.
What up? This is the real Rick Ross, and you're listening to me on the Murder Master Music Show.
Now real niggas do real things, and I hang with the real. So if you fuck with my family, you fuck with me. Hey, UGS for life.
For all them fuck boys disrespecting the team, flipping snippets from the show and they saluting the name. The underground society, real talk on the scene. Y'all gon' fuck around, be left white chalked on the scene. It's UGS for life for you busters that don't know. I'm down with Praise and Mac J, the Murder Master Music Show. Archives of legends with questions you wanna know. That's why them whole shows be slick listening on the low. Recent episodes for they shows with no recognition. More than suspicion when you can hear Praise voice if you listen. Disrespect, I'm ripping. Bitch, I'm flipping. Kill their credentials whenever their name get mentioned. From Pittsburgh Patrick, they gon' teach them some manners. Grab the ball bat and show up at they door in bandanas. For screaming real hip-hop and supporting them swag. Show up at their club for breakfast, sell a bag in the basket. Take aim at the lane, put his career in the casket. I come to kill a Mac J, make him pay for their actions. They can't pay him, smashing in an orderly fashion. With no permission, I'm asking.
Mash it and attack it.
Turning taxing for every question Scott be asking. You can steal from the real, but yet you still can't outlast him. UGS for life, that's steel to plastic. Got that iron in my blood, burn your soul like acid.
You know? You better ask, nigga. UGS for life. Where the real at? Punk ass niggas. www.ugsforlife.com. Where the real is at?
Hey, what's up, everybody? This is episode 379 of the Murder Master Music Show. I'll tell you what, tonight is a real special show. I had the honor of watching a film over the last couple days, Tupac Assassination Battle for Compton. I've seen so many documentaries about, you know, Tupac and Biggie over the years and you know, got on YouTube and saw so many different theories and whatnot. Just when you thought things couldn't slap you in the face a little bit more, this is really one of those films that you need to see because it points out a lot of things that have kind of not really been focused on much in the media attention. And R.J. Bond, he's the man that put this together. He's the director of the film. As a matter of fact, this is the third in the series, if I'm not mistaken. I'm going to bring him on right now. We're just going to go over some incredible shit tonight for you guys. RJ, how you doing, brother?
I'm good, man. Man, what was it, 397? Is that how many shows you've done?
379.
I got it backwards. There. Yeah, no. Congratulations. That's awesome, man. That's great.
Thank you, man. I'll tell you what. I sat down and watched this movie, and, you know, at first, like within the first 20 minutes or so, I was almost convinced that Snoop had something to do with it. and then from there, I mean, it just keeps building and building and building until finally you see it, like, oh, wow. You know what I'm saying? It implicates LAPD very, very strongly, and we'll get into that in a minute, but... putting, you know, you've done a few of these documentaries, RJ. Putting this one together, how difficult was it? Because you had so much information in the past. How difficult was it to put this together and present it like it is? Because it's got some pretty damning evidence in it.
You know, it's a great question. I hate to split this in half, but on one side, it was the easiest thing that I've done because it was a stream of consciousness. But on the other hand of it, it was – I think I wanted to just say, let's say what we have to say, and if we have to burn the house down, we'll burn the house down. But,
yeah.
I mean, the original cut for this movie was going to be 10 hours. We were going to do, you know, you've seen that Making a Murderer show. That's on the cable. And it's like, you know, we thought about doing a 10-part docu-series where we would have taken kind of every segment of the movie and really fleshed it out. We have enough material for that. It's amazing. Like you said, there's such a volume of stuff out there. And just honestly, I've been doing this over 10 years now with this being part three. You were right about that. And I got kind of to the point where it was like, well, do I want to do 10 hours of this, or do I think I could try to get the gist of it done in a shorter period of time? Because who's got time to sit around and watch 10 hours of a documentary, really, you know, when it comes down to it? So we put our heads together, and I pissed off my distributor like crazy because they wanted it under 2 hours. They always like it when it's conveniently fit into 2 hours. But we put it out at 2.5, and, you know, my biggest fear was that people wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't hook on, because 2.5 hours can go by fast if you're enjoying it or if you're watching, if you hook on. But, man, 2.5 hours can also be a lifetime if you're not getting it, or if somehow you're lost. So that was the hard part about cutting a picture, cutting it together.
You had to be careful to make sure to tie, like a puzzle, tie everything together to when they're done watching it, they go back and be like, wow. And that's kind of what it did for me. Okay, and another thing, I want to go back to what I said earlier. Can you reflect a little bit on Snoop and Pac, how their relationship was deteriorating, and, you know what I'm saying? Because it almost like, wow, did Snoop do this? I was like, fuck, I hope not. What was the deal with that?
Well, you know, I think it's really, we're in an amazing time right now, because, you know, Snoop is being attacked on a lot of different fronts, from the Long Beach Crips to, you know, Big Flossie and them to, you know, the media and some of the kind of harebrained things I think he's doing these days. You know, he's being seen in a much different light. I'm not going to say what the true light is, but, you know, I think the public sees for themselves, you know, what's real and what's not. And if you look at it through today's eyes, as we look at these people and who they are and what they've become, it kind of lets us understand a little bit more about the animal that they were back in the day. And so when we look at that, and we say, okay, you know, what was his relationship with Pac? Well, to say that relationship was strained was, you know, kind of the understatement of the year, because even deeper than the relationship that Snoop had with Pac and the problems that they had was really a bigger problem between the Dog Pound, who were largely a Crip-based set, and the Death Row artists and the Outlaws and the people that were there that were of the Blood, the Pyru set, and sort of that natural rivalry that they did their best to overcome for the sake of making a buck. But, you know, it was always there, and that undercurrent was always there. So, you know, you're already starting with the glass half full of animosity when you look at the relationship between the Crips and the Bloods trying to make it work. So it's kind of a stacked deck. Then you take their big guy, Snoop, who's making some money for the record label, who's doing some good things for the record label, and then and a big power play, Suge brings in Tupac, who's a grand slam home run hitter. Now you've got Joe DiMaggio and Babe Ruth on the same team. And so that would naturally just escalate things further. You know, one of the things I think that we bring out in the movie was that, you know, Pac found out after he got to work with both Dre and Snoop, that's why he wanted to go to Death Row, that he didn't like either one of them when it came right down to it. And so having that, you know, background and understanding that, yeah, there was some tension between the two of them, and I think that's ultimately what led to the events of September 7th.
So okay, and from, I mean, you know, from there we can tie it obviously to the LAPD and whatnot, but you had a scene in the film where Tupac's aunt says Tupac was not a gangster. And there was people, his manager, I believe, I forget his name, Pac advised, or Pac said he wanted to go to Death Row, wanted to work with Snoop and Dre and everything, and they advised him not to do it.
Right. Adrian Gregory, Adrian Gregory.
Yeah, they advised him not to go. But his aunt said he wasn't a gangster. Was Pac just like guilty by association pretty much? Is that what you're saying? Or was he a full-blown gangster?
No, I think that Pac, you know, it's an interesting thing. Frank Alexander said that Pac wasn't red or blue. Pac's color was green, and that was the color of money. You know, that was the thing.
Yeah.
The people, I mean, you got to look at it this way. In the assassination movies overall, I've interviewed at least a dozen people that were – you can't find people that were closer to Tupac than a Tracy Robinson, Layla Steinberg, Adrian Gregory, Frank Alexander. These people that were with him every single day, in the studio, out of the studio, at home, you know, all of these people that knew him have all said the same thing. They said that he was not a gangster, that he was not – he had no desire to be tied up with the gangs officially. However, there's a certain mystique that's with it, and I think it's kind of parallel to Snoop's relationship with the Crips. You know, you're not really officially a part of it, but you're kind of borrowing off of that street cred that they've given you by association. So I think the best way to explain Pac's situation was that, and we try to explain this in the movie, that there's a fast-moving river. You know, picture yourself coming to the banks of a river that's moving very, very fast. And at the end of that river, there's a waterfall. There's a cliff, okay? Basically, what that waterfall was the flow of all the bad things that were going on at the time. And I look at Tupac as being thrown in the river. He kind of jumped in the river himself, actually. And he found himself carried away by that river. And, of course, over the cliff we go. And that was kind of the visual I had in my mind when we put Assassination together, to give you that, show you the river, show you how fast it was moving and how dangerous it was, and then show you how Pac jumped into that river. And there's all kinds of treachery in that river, including Dog Pound. I mean, they didn't like Pac. They were always competing for time. They had it in. You heard Daz. You know, they had no love for Show or Pac, either one.
Well, yeah, that's it's crazy to think, you know what I'm saying?
Here you have
a multi-million dollar record label. Everybody's making money. Everybody's doing things, doing shows, doing collaborations. Put all that street shit aside and work together for one common goal. But no, you can't do that. Not with that much money involved.
Yeah, you can take the boy out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the boy. I think that's the old saying. You know, the baggage is going to go with you. You know, that's really what it comes down to. It's going to go with you. And, I mean, but the music industry, you think about it realistically, the music industry is all about, you know, a lot of ego involved anyway. Wouldn't even matter if you had the gang problem. There's still ego. You know, everybody wants to. I think I just listened to an interview with Idi Amin, who he said, you know, the whole nature of rap is you want to go in there challenging and you want to go in with this attitude like you're better than everybody else. So it's almost just like the nature of the beast. So I guess you could say it was set up, you know, kind of set up to fail from the beginning.
Definitely, man. And you know, the old Ruthless thing, that's a whole other movie right there,
sure,
which I hope gets made, and not in the form of Straight Outta Compton, but in the form of a good in-depth documentary. Have you ever thought about touching that?
Yeah, you know what? It's funny because we've increased scope. I mean, there's been some people that have criticized me and said, well, if you really watch the assassination documentaries, they've changed the documentaries. They're telling a different story than they were originally. And yes, we've taken Shug off the hook where we kind of blame Shug a lot. But we, you know, I like to think that the documentaries have just expanded, that the world is in, you know, gotten bigger as we've gotten into these documentaries. Like, this is the first time we really touched on Christopher Wallace was in this documentary. The other two assassination movies didn't have anything to do with Biggie at all. So we've included him now. So if we were to do another one in the assassination series, if you wanted to call it that, that would be a natural exploration, is to see, you know, what other elements were involved that might have led these people to make the decisions that they made. You know, what made Suge Knight Suge Knight? You know, that's a documentary all by itself, you know, really. And well, that Ruthless and the explanation of that would all kind of dovetail right into that. So, yeah, it would be fun.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I love the fact that, you touch on Biggie in this, because you know, we'll get into that a little bit later. First, I want to focus in a little bit on the night of the shooting. In the documentary, it kind of focuses in on that it was more set up to be a Suge Knight hit than a Tupac hit, and Tupac was kind of just, you know, there, so to speak. You kind of even look at Sharissa, her relationship with Kevin Gaines, Reggie Wright. There's a lot of different things and aspect to look at. And do you think Suge Knight was the intended target of this, and Pac wasn't supposed to be killed?
I was gonna ask you, what was your takeaway? How did you feel about that? How did you feel about where the story led? What was your impression? Was it difficult to buy? I guess that would be the question. Was it difficult to buy that?
I'll tell you what, when you tied the LAPD involvement to Biggie, it kind of made sense to me, RJ, because I'll tell you why. The cover-up of Tupac with all, I mean, because it's not a secret. There is a lot of LAPD involved in Death Row. You know what I'm saying? It was almost like LAPD infiltrated the label. I mean, that's what it looked like to me after soaking up all this information.
You got to realize,
like, some of them might have got the, maybe possibly his wife. Maybe there was other things. You know, kind of like you look at the spectrum of EZ. I just mentioned him. You know, when we had Jerry Heller on the show, Jerry Heller told us, follow the money. Who had the most gain? Suge Knight did get rubbed out. Obviously, you definitely would want to look in that direction of his wife. Yeah, for sure.
We've talked about this with Suge's attorneys. We've talked with this with Suge indirectly. And you gotta take a look at the shooting itself. And I'm gonna break it down for a minute to one specific thing. Focus for a minute on the shooting, okay? You get this guy, no matter who it is, no matter what his motive is, it doesn't matter. You're going to go up and you're going to drive a car, you're going to shoot however many rounds into a car that's standing still at an intersection in Las Vegas, okay? You with me? It doesn't matter who it is. Somebody's going to do that. And in that car is Tupac Shakur, biggest rapper at that time, and Suge Knight. Now, take Tupac out of the car for a minute. Let's take him out of the car. Just make him disappear for a minute. And what do you have? You got the biggest man in the music industry, arguably, at that time. Okay, certainly the biggest in rap. And one of the most dangerous when you think of the amount of street cred, money, access to weapons, access to police. One of the most dangerous men you could have out there. And let's say you killed Tupac and Suge's still standing there, you don't think he's going to want to know who put a hit out on him? It's one thing to say, all right, we followed Pac and we chased him down and we saw him in front of his apartment complex, kind of like the Gaddafi hit where you could drug him out by himself and they shot him and that was the end of it. But no matter how mad you are at Tupac or Suge, if you're going to shoot at one of them, you better get both of them, because the guy that's the most dangerous one in the car is the one that's left standing. Yeah. And Vegas police kind of tipped us off to that, because Brent Becker said, you know, the investigation of the killing or attempted killing of a CEO of a company, that's one kind of investigation. But this is the music business, so it's a little bit different. And it started us thinking that, you know, maybe Vegas was kind of wise to what was being going on. And that led us backwards to reverse engineer it. And we thought to ourselves, okay, so why would somebody want to kill Suge Knight? Because you have to ask yourself that. I mean, why would somebody want to kill Tupac? Well, the obvious answer that everybody's talked about, Orlando Anderson, it was that, you know, I'm going to get you back for beating me up at the MGM. And, you know, there it is, case closed. But even if you go with that theory, you still have to explain why somebody would be brazen enough to try to kill Suge Knight, too, because Suge Knight was on the other side of the car. That's not an easy thing to do. No matter how mad you spray that car, you know, there's always a chance you could miss. And then what are going to be the repercussions if you do?
Yeah.
You feel me?
When you
look at it that way, you just, Tupac, just take him out of the car for a minute, and you look at whoever that shooter was or whatever the motives were. They weren't just shooting at Tupac. They knowingly shot at the most powerful man in the record business at that time. Now, that's some major, major huevos right there. Don't matter who you are, okay?
Yeah.
Because you better kill him. Otherwise,
well, I always
you've
said, too, RJ, not to cut you off, but I always said, too, like when people try to say Suge Knight was involved, it's like, why the hell would you put yourself in the car that's going to get shot up? I mean, that's the obvious
and you know
first
what?
Question.
And you know what?
Yeah.
Admittedly, I have to be the one, and I've gone on record as saying this before. You know, when we did the first assassination movies, we got towards Suge Knight and said, well, he certainly had motive to do it, but we could never get past that. We could never get past what you just said. He was in the car. Now, we could think of a lot of examples where, you know, I mean, Suge shot himself in the leg. I mean, you know, he's not opposed to hurting himself if it gets him something in the end. But you really have to look at the common sense of that and say, okay, would he be that brave to say, well, shoot at everything else, hit him, but don't hit me? We could never make that. We could only make a dotted line. We could never connect the dots directly. And that left us open in the first couple of assassination movies. That left us open to some criticism because some people said, well, you're pointing the finger at Suge. And we kind of were indirectly, but we could never make that connection. We could never say definitively, you know, we could never get around that problem. That was always just a big rock in the river, so to speak. And so you can imagine the relief that we felt when we were able to actually make an adjustment to our theory, and it didn't change any of the underlying stuff we'd already said. You know, the guards were still told not to carry their weapons and radios and the whole nine yards. It didn't change it, but what it did was it actually changed the perspective. It allowed us to turn it a different degree and look at it from a different angle. And so you're absolutely right. That was something that we could never get past. But if you ask any good detective, any good law enforcement, you know, detective or a private investigator, it's okay to be wrong. It's okay to say, well, that didn't work out. We went down that path. It didn't work out. So let's go back a few steps. Let's dial it back as far as we need to. And let's look at it a different way. Let's see what works. You know, you just keep running the play till you get it right. You don't stop.
I respect you for doing that, man, because a lot of people, they'll put out their version or whatever of what happened or what they say happened, and they'll stick to it. You're willing to go back and look at things again, interview people again. You know, hats off to you for being thorough. You know, a lot of people put a film. I mean, you've done three of these. A lot of people put a film out on it, and that's it. You know, is that when other people? Let me ask you this, RJ. When other people put out films on this subject, and it's not, you know, I'm saying aligning with the work you've done and the research you've done. Does that drive you further to say, you know what, I'm gonna do another one. I'm gonna go back to work again.
Well, I can't.
Competitive nature,
I mean,
maybe.
Yeah, I can't lie. There's always that. I mean, there just is. There's always that. You know, first off, I don't think anybody likes to be told that they're nuts, or they don't like to be told that their baby's ugly either. So you know, so when I hear, well, the movie wasn't, you know, technically well put together, and, you know, and it looked like it was made for $10, whatever the case might be. You know, that kind of stuff always kind of gigs you a little bit. You know, you feel like, ah, nice, thanks. But, I would say, yes, there's a certain competitive nature. But for me, especially after losing, you know, my best friend and godfather to my son, Frank Alexander, after losing him, and
rest
then
peace,
Russ Poole, rest in peace, Funk Soul Brother Frank, and then losing Russ Poole right in the middle of our working on, you know, trying to finalize what his work was and the things that he was trying to get done, you know, that really, then it drives you at that point. There's something more to what's going on, and these people can't lose their lives for nothing. And so that really did drive it to say, let's try to get as close as we can to finishing this. It may not be perfect, but we'll fix that later. That does bug me. But what bugs me more, I think, is just when people lie, when they just flat out lie. They make movies and they say, and they just flat out lie about things. And that I think that's what drives me nuts more than anything, is when you have people that are self-proclaimed investigators or self-proclaimed reporters, investigative reporters, and they put out absolute nonsense. They put out stuff that is just not true. And that, to me, that's what really drives me, because I want to make sure that people aren't fooled. I just think there's been too much of that in this investigation, and that's why everybody's in a tailspin about it right now.
Well, let's talk a little bit on Russell Poole for a minute. You know, they're getting ready. Johnny Depp's getting ready to play him, which originally was going to be Stallone in the movie Labyrinth. It's coming out. What are your thoughts on that movie? And since you work so closely with Poole, are you having any involvement in it?
Well, actually, you know, it's funny. I remember I was actually there. I was interviewing Randall Sullivan, who wrote the book Labyrinth. I was actually interviewing him right at the time that they were locking down the final details to getting a distribution deal done. And so that was very exciting at that time to see that that was going to go through, because, you know, that really kind of chronicled the beginning of Russell's work on the case and, you know, his battles with the LAPD. Unfortunately, I'm not directly involved with the picture at all. You know, I know that I've been in contact, well, with Randall. I mean, obviously, you can't get too much better than, you know, the guy who wrote the book. You can't, you know, and I'm in contact with Randall. But even he at this point, because they wrote a script and they're working their story, even he has minimal, you know, input or involvement into the movie. It's kind of like the Tupac biopic. You know, once it gets down a certain path and the studio likes the script, they're going to play things how they play things. And so my feeling is that they're going to portray Russell in a different caricature than I would portray him or that I've known him. But I think at the end of the day, as long as they honor the work that he's done, whether or not they portray him as a, you know, a drunkard, or whether or not they portray him as a, you know, a rebel or a loner, or, you know, a guy just who want to get along with anybody, whatever the flaws they want to give him. As long as they honor the work that he's done. And I think at the end of the day, because clearly it was Randall Sullivan's book, I mean, that definitely had a conclusion and had a definite politics about it. I think that they will honor that. And for that reason, I'm very excited to see what they come up with.
Yeah, definitely. Looks like, it'd be an interesting film. No, another thing I wanted to touch on, too, was the actual letter. You touched on four. I forget who wrote the letter, RJ, if you want to refresh me on that, please.
You touched on four
main things in the letter. Demo stealing, which, you know, we had a guy in here that said, you know, he had a whole briefcase, ADAT stolen. Which was a common thing at that time, still goes on today. The Tupac beating, Little Half Dead, and Reggie Wright Jr. Let's start with Reggie Wright Jr. first.
Okay.
His name seems to always come up. He was the guy, if I'm not mistaken, that told, according to Frank Alexander, Michael Moore, and others, to leave their weapons in the cars, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. Yeah, there was.
Now,
there
here's
was,
my question there, about him that I want to have you touch on, RJ. The day, a couple days later, Suge called a meeting, the offices of Death Row. Reggie had a secret meeting outside the offices. What did he say to Frank Alexander and everybody else before that meeting?
Well, Frank wasn't at the meeting. Frank, Michael Moore was at the meeting, and a couple of the bodyguards. I think Kenny Archer may have been in there. I'm not positive, but this Michael Moore was at this meeting that was called at Death Row headquarters. Yeah, Frank was, I won't say he was hiding, but that's pretty much what he was laying low, because, you know, with that shit storm that came down and him being the main bodyguard there. You know, it didn't look well for him. And of course, we talk about that, the meeting that they had, when Suge found out that Pac had actually died and he threw a phone across the table, fell in the pool. You know, Frank was right there. Reggie told Frank, you know, you need to get out of here right now. When Reggie called that meeting at Death Row, Michael Moore says that he had his own meeting with the guards outside before they went in to talk to the artist, because the artist wanted to know what the hell happened. I mean, you know, here you've got just not Suge Knight, but everybody was nervous about that. In fact, we have a source that actually told us that he was with Hammer and was one of Hammer's bodyguards. And when Hammer's entourage found out and their bodyguards found out that no one was allowed to carry any weapons, one of his main bodyguards, one of his main guys, told Hammer to leave Las Vegas, get out of there. This is going to be a bad situation because your guys are going unarmed and that's not going to happen. Well, Hammer didn't want to leave, and this guy actually left himself. He left Vegas because he was not going to be a part of something where people were running around with no guns. So the artists were really questioning what was happening with this whole thing about, you know, what happened. And so Reggie pulled Michael Moore aside and a couple of the other guards had a meeting outside there and told them, do not talk about not carrying your weapons, because we know from the interviews that Suge Knight did with Vegas police that he fully expected that they would have their weapons on, that Frank would be armed, that they'd all be armed. And this notion that they're not supposed to, I mean, I've heard it say, oh, well, that meeting was just telling them, they didn't really say not to carry their weapons. They were told that there was a permit issue and you couldn't carry a concealed weapon in Nevada with permit. If you didn't have a permit, you couldn't carry a gun. Well, Nevada is an open carry state. Nevada, you can carry a firearm anywhere in the city of Los Angeles, of Las Vegas, in the state of Nevada, you can open carry a firearm. So the whole argument that they needed a permit, why would you need a permit? If you could carry it on you openly, why would you need to be concerned whether or not you had a concealed weapon or not? You carry it openly. What does it matter at that point? So it kind of lets that whole area of the argument that they went to the attorney's place and they had to sign documents that said that they wouldn't carry a concealed weapon. Well, that's just a bunch of crap. It's not true. Nobody's produced a single document. Nobody's produced any evidence of that whatsoever that was ever said. And when they went to that meeting, Reggie told Michael Moore and them to not even mention the subject that they were told not to carry any weapons. Because obviously, who's the one that told them not to carry any weapons, right? So yeah. Michael Moore then defied that, went into that meeting because he was so upset, and spoke up. Because he said that Reggie wasn't going to say anything. Reggie wasn't going to speak up. And it left them all kind of vulnerable because here's all these artists thinking these security guards are idiots. So Michael Moore spoke up and said, we were told not to carry our weapons. Now, as we had in the movie, we've got, you know, we have a corroborating witness. We have Suge's driver, who's Death Row Dave Matthews. Death Row Dave Matthews raised the stakes by saying not only did they have that meeting with the guards in the morning, but there was a second meeting that was held in the afternoon where even the cops that were there were told not to carry any weapons. So how do you tell cops not to carry any weapons? Of course, they're going to make up their own minds whether they're going to or not. But at the end of the day, when you have more than one person telling the same story, you know, why would three or four different people lie about that? Why would they make that up? And so you've got Reggie in there telling Michael Moore, according to Michael Moore, don't say anything about the weapons. Now, let's talk about Michael Moore for a quick second. You got to realize, and I don't have this in this last movie, but if you go back and watch the first assassination movie, there's something very important to know about Michael Moore. Michael Moore did not like Tupac. Didn't like him. And the reason he didn't like him was because I think it was, and the same thing happened with Leslie Galdon, who was another one of the bodyguards there. Pac was sometimes asking him to go do some favors for him that weren't exactly legal things to do, you know. And these guys didn't like, you know, kind of getting in the middle of all that. And they felt like they were kind of being taken advantage of by Tupac. And they, you know, ordered around and stuff like that, being errand boys and doing illegal things like getting guns or whatever the case might be. And Michael Moore didn't like Tupac, didn't like him. He would work with him. He'd be his bodyguard, but he didn't like him. So why would a guy who doesn't like Tupac have a motive to get up there and say anything other than the truth? What does it benefit him?
Yeah, if you don't like him, exactly, why would he be sticking up for him, so to speak?
Right. That's
trying to find the answers. Definitely. I get you. We got a quick caller here. He has a question. My co-host worked in the green room. His name is Jason. Jason, what's up?
Yeah, can you guys hear me? How you guys doing?
We're doing real good.
We're good
tonight.
Thanks for calling. Okay.
Make sure you check out this movie, Tupac Assassination.
Oh, man, I can't wait to check it out. R.J. Bond, I watched all your stuff. And I'm glad you are stepping up and calling out Snoop for being the Tupac hater he is. And I've been noticing that for, like, the last 20 years, it felt like. But it seems like nobody else noticed that. Because he always say slick stuff during interviews and all that. The hatred just pours out of him when Tupac is mentioned.
It does.
You know, you're right. I could see it, and people act like they don't see it. And I'm glad you got the guts to step up and do some investigating and really put it on blast. Like, it wasn't all peaches and cream. And I haven't seen your documentary yet. When does it drop?
Oh, it's out already. It came out last Friday. Yeah, it's out.
Oh, okay.
You can go to Google Play. You can go to Amazon Prime, Amazon.com. Like I said, iTunes, I think it hits Monday on iTunes. So, you know, however way you want to get it, you can get it.
Okay, well, I'll be watching it tonight. But I was wondering, did you touch on what they doing to Suge Knight right now? Like, the fact that Suge Knight can't get any visits, he can't even talk on the phone, he can't even sit with his lawyer. Like, it's unconstitutional what they doing to Suge Knight right now. And everybody act like they don't care or don't notice.
Well, we don't talk about that directly. No, you bring up a great point. We feel the same way. But I can't believe what's happening to Suge. You know, that the violation of his constitutional rights just goes right through the roof. You know, and again, I think when you watch the movie, what you're going to come away with is an understanding that, you know, the people that wanted Suge Knight gone and the reason he was a target was because there were just certain people that had things to protect or had things that they were doing that Suge Knight was a risk to. Suge Knight was drawing a lot of attention to himself. He was drawing a lot of attention to his own antics, you know, getting in trouble with the law and all that. And these guys don't need to spend $100 million operation. They don't need to lose that or expose that to a guy who's deciding to go off and beat up some dude on the street for no reason. So they're in the movie, we talk about the fact that these guys, you know, have a motive to want to get rid of Suge. And when that doesn't work, what's the next thing you can do? You really can't go and shoot him again. I mean, they tried at One Oak Club. You know, there were sheriffs that were there, you know, that were in the middle of that whole thing. But when you can't get rid of somebody, you can't kill somebody, the only thing you can do is isolate them and throw them so far away from everybody that they have no way of contacting the outside world. And I think it's absolutely atrocious what they're doing to him. I know that they have given him at least his family, I think, can talk to him now. I think his mom can talk to him. I think there's a couple people that can talk to him. We talked to Suge's attorneys. We talked with Thaddeus Culpepper, who is one of Suge's attorneys. And, you know, we're able to communicate indirectly with him and Toy and a lot of the people that are in his camp, because we do feel strongly about that. And Russ Poole was actually going to apologize to Suge directly before he died. He was going to apologize to him for pointing the finger at him for all those years.
Yeah. Well, Russ Poole died mysteriously. He died at a meeting, if I'm not mistaken. Michael Douglas Carlin said that he went to a meeting with LAPD officers and supposedly he had a heart attack right there and died. That sounds suspicious as hell to me. I mean, it's like, here you are, you're kind of ousted by the people you worked for, and you happen to die at a meeting with them. What are your thoughts on that?
This was kind of a double screw, actually. We got screwed twice on this one. The first thing is that Russ was actually at the LA County Sheriff's Department. He was at their headquarters when he died. And we got screwed twice because Russell and I, sometime earlier, had actually, when we got the confession letter from Chris Blatchford at Fox News, we weren't sure what we were going to do with it. The thing that we saw in the letter right away was that Reggie Wright's name was mentioned, and this letter hadn't seen the light of day since 1998. Nobody knew who Reggie Wright really was before, I think, Nick Broomfield's documentary came out, and then, of course, the assassination movies. But that was 2006. That was 8 years after this letter had been written, and nobody knew who he was. So when we got the letter, and it, you know, there's some far-reaching things in that letter. It's there's so much depth to that letter in such a short letter. And when you look at, you know, all the details of that and the credibility that's in that letter, the only thing that we could think to do, and I, of course, I called some people that I trusted very much about what to do about it. What, you know, what do you do when you get this knowledge? You got one of two choices. You either go figure it out yourself and take a chance of figuring it out and be Columbo and try to figure all that out, or you give it to the people that know how to do these things, okay? So let's suppose for a minute that you have a hot lead, and maybe these people over the past 20 years have kind of let their guard down because they figured that, you know, the heat's off. It's been a long time. Everybody's still looking at Orlando Anderson. So, you know, everybody's head's turned. And maybe they've just relaxed a little bit, you know. Maybe they can put Tupac hunched over dead on a console on the front of their record album, you know. Maybe they could do that. Maybe that's an inside joke, but maybe there's no heat. And maybe law enforcement might have an opportunity to kind of catch these guys off guard because you know how they roll. I mean, that's what they do. That's how they do what they do. And so we were at a crossroads of how we were going to handle this. We said, well, what do we do? Do we, you know, look at it ourselves? Do we have that kind of muscle, that kind of clout that we could go interrogate people? No. So what we decided to do was go to the Los Angeles Police Department, and we went up to the top of Parker Center, the very highest floor at the LAPD headquarters, and we met with Deputy Chief of Police there, the head of robbery homicide, the another one of the robbery homicide investigators, and we left that meeting, and it wasn't even 2 weeks later that the LAPD leaked that confession letter. We got screwed. We got screwed by the LAPD big time on that one. I mean, when you go to somebody, we weren't even originally going to put any real names in the book, in Tupac 187, the book. We were just going to make reference to the fact that there was a letter that made some allegations. But they put it out, and they put the names on blast. It wasn't us. They put the names out on blast. The people that leaked it through LAPD put those names out there. So
yeah.
I was always curious to know what Russ was thinking when they decided to go to, when he decided to go to the sheriff's department. But I know that Russ had been meeting with county prosecutors, LA County prosecutors. He had been meeting with some people because if the LAPD weren't going to do something about it, Russ was just wanting somebody in law enforcement to do something about it. We, you know, he talked to Jim Peterson is his name. I'm trying to think that the new sheriff. Now the guy is the sheriff now. Russ talked with him, Jim McDonald, that's right, Jim McDonald, the sheriff. And Russ and Michael arranged with Jim McDonald, the LA County Sheriff, to go there and talk to Jim McDonald about the case, about what the One Oak Club shooting that involved the sheriffs and Suge Knight and this theory that we had. And I was a little baffled by it, to be honest with you, because I couldn't understand. We'd already been screwed by one law enforcement agency. I'm not really sure I would have done it twice, you know what I mean? I wouldn't be the guy to go back and say, hey, you guys should just, you know, maybe you guys will do the right thing. These guys didn't, but maybe you will. Because you just never know about these guys, you know. They have their own agenda. So Russ went, and not only did he not meet with Jim McDonald, but he met with two other detectives. And one of the detectives that he met with, Russell had had prior dealings with that hadn't been very good dealings. Let's just put it that way. They didn't really get along. And then Russ drops dead of a heart attack right there at the sheriff's department. So
yeah,
that's
not even
that's
meeting
the
with the guy he's supposed to meet with, and then just
right.
drops dead. I mean, I mean, yeah, I can imagine because you and him, you guys work closely together. That was your friend.
Yeah, Russell lived at my house. Russell stayed with me for a period of time. They were moving. They were going from one house to another house. And Russ actually stayed. Russ and his wife stayed with us at our house. I mean, I knew this guy, you know, like a brother.
Yeah.
And I just – it was not in his personality. Yeah, Russ would get upset about things. But Russ was one of these kind of blowhard guys that he could express himself outwardly. You know, tell you off or tell you where to go piss up a rope or whatever. And, you know, you don't associate people like that with having like a heart attack because they externalize. They get it all out. You know, they don't hold it all in. People that hold it all in get a heart attack. That's how they work. But Russ wasn't like that. So the fact that he had a heart attack still sits weird with me. You know, I'm not quite ready to go into some of the deeper, you know, conspiracy theories about, you know, what happened there. I do think it was odd. I wished he wouldn't have been there. I can tell you that. I wished he hadn't gone.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Definitely. Well, rest in peace to him. It's crazy because, you know, you look at the LAPD as a whole, like I said, they were part of Death Row. They were working hand in hand with the label. And there's so many different, it was like I said earlier, it's almost like the label was infiltrated, almost hijacked from within.
Well, the FBI says there were LAPD cops working at Death Row. I can never understand why a certain book author has sworn up and down there were never any officers employed by Death Row Records, you know, why he says that adamantly. You know, because I think that's just semantics. I mean, we know LAPD worked with Death Row. We know they worked for Right Way Security. We know that they worked for Code 4 Security, which was the name of Right Way Security before Reggie took it over and it was Right Way. So we know these things happen, and we have the documents and the evidence in there, in that document, to prove it. So, you know, I can't understand why people are still on the fence about whether or not there were cops over Death Row. We know there were cops over Death Row. No question.
Yeah. Well, so, the evidence is out there. All you got to do is look at it.
Yep.
You know, David Mack, of course.
Definitely.
And I mean, I don't want to give too much away because I want people to go see this film. Everybody right now, make sure you go check out Tupac Assassination, Battle for Compton. But I do want to touch on the LAPD involvement that you discuss in the film about Biggie Smalls, because this is, I never really heard this theory before, never really paid attention to it, because I always just assumed, like millions of other people, that, Biggie's out there on the West Coast, he's doing his thing, he's kind of flaunting, hey, I'm untouchable, whatnot, and boom, there he goes. You know, it's just East Coast, West Coast war. Why? Because it's easy to believe, right? But when you paint this picture with all this stuff that you guys uncovered, man, it looks pretty fucked up. Tell everybody, RJ, about the connection between Biggie's homicide and the LAPD that you guys uncovered.
Well, you know, the genesis of a lot of the explanation of what happens comes from a witness that the LAPD tried to discredit, but they couldn't. And so instead of trying to bring this witness out and show this witness that shared a jail cell with Rafael Perez at the time, and his name is Ken Boagney, or actually Ken Boagney is how it's pronounced. Everybody calls it Boagney, but it's actually Boagney, B-O-A-G-N-I, Ken Boagney. Ken shared a cell with him. Now, a lot of what Rafael Perez told him while they were in the jail cell, sharing the jail cell together, wasn't just about, you know, Biggie. He talked about a lot of stuff. And the LAPD used his testimony to clear five police officers. LAPD has what are called border rights hearings. Because cops are union, they have an opportunity to kind of have a trial if they get brought up on charges like they did something wrong or they stole or they shot somebody and they shouldn't have. The LAPD has their own little court system. It's called a border rights hearing. And so that police officer gets put up basically on trial by the border rights, and then they bring witnesses that can say whether or not this guy's guilty or innocent of what he did. Five cops had charges brought against them for doing wrongful things, doing bad things. And in five different cases, the information that Kenny Boagney told the Board of Rights cleared every one of those five officers. So clearly the LAPD believed that Ken Boagney's testimony was credible. There's no question about it. Why would you call somebody back five times to get your guys off the hook? Okay, you got that same guy. Now, but suddenly when this same guy who's got all this other information you believed comes and starts telling you about all this other thing about Biggie, the LAPD turn around and say, oh, he's just a jailhouse guy. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He's nuts. Well, the problem is he's not, because you just used him to clear five of your own guys. So how could you turn around and say he's nuts now? You can't. Doesn't work like that. So what the LAPD did, instead of acknowledging this guy's existence and saying, okay, yeah, all right, you know, yeah, we did, so this guy's credible, because that would basically mean what he was telling was the truth, what they did was they hid this guy. They took all of the interviews that they had done with him, they took all the information about him, even his name, and they hid it. And the judge found out about it in the Wallace civil trial, that they tried to hide any testimony from Ken Bogany about anything having to do with Rafael Perez. The LAPD put it in the desk drawer of Stephen Katz, who was one of their detectives there, and they hid it. They didn't produce it for the Wallace family. They told the Wallace family, no, there's nothing about that. This guy's just a nut job. You know, there's nothing there. Well, they found out, the Wallace family found out that they were hiding it. The judge gave an order. And the first time in history, the LAPD's robbery homicide division was shut down for the day while they went in and started looking through desk drawers trying to find out that information. You know what they found? They found Kenny Bogany's testimony, and it wasn't good for the LAPD. And what made it worse for the LAPD was when that judge found out that, sure enough, they had found that information, the judge fined the city of Los Angeles $1 million for hiding that stuff. So you got to know,
right,
if it's worth $1 million, huh?
Yeah. No, I was going to say, with all this happening, I mean, you would think that they would just turn the spotlight right down on them and do a massive investigation, kind of like, I don't know if you're familiar with Betty Lauren Maltese out of Cicero. You know, her husband was a mob figure in Chicago in the 50s. When she became town president of Cicero, they had to have the feds come in and fire the entire police force.
That's right.
With all this damning evidence, and these guys are just still pushing it under the rug. It's crazy.
Well, you got to realize, I mean, if you're willing to risk $1 million for something, it's got to be important.
Yeah.
And of course, that's what, when we got on the phone with Kenny, we called him up, and we just asked the question: what is it that you had to say that was, you know, worth $1 million to these guys? Why were they fighting so hard to keep what you had to say out of the, you know, away from the Wallace family? Well, you know, like Jerry Heller said, follow the money. You know, I just learned that the city of Los Angeles is trying to borrow $170 million right now as we speak to pay for claims, people that have won claims against the city in lawsuits or settlements or whatever, and the city of Los Angeles ain't got the money to pay it, so they're going to have to go borrow $170 million just to pay this year's settlement claims. Forget about next year. So you think about how much money Biggie Wallace would have made in his lifetime, okay? Half a billion dollars, $500 million maybe, if he had kept going the way he was going with that trajectory. So when you think about that, and then you triple the damages in, because it's a, you know, wrongful death claim, you triple the damages there, you're talking about a $1.5 to $2 billion judgment against the city of Los Angeles. They can't pay that. They can't even pay $170 million right now. So what options do you have? I mean, it's that serious. I mean, you look at the judge that they had at the time, and of course she died later. That's why the case got thrown out, because that judge was so hard on the LAPD, she died. And they got a new judge, and the new judge was the complete opposite. It was just pro-LAPD and basically kind of shut them down. But the big thing about it, this judge, she didn't think anything of fining them $1 million just for pissing her off. Can you imagine what that verdict would have come back like?
Crazy. It, so many people, you know, and then you go back once again to the Suge Knight thing with his wife at the time, her and White, they it almost looks like they had a plot going from the evidence you guys uncovered. Has she ever been investigated that you know of?
Well, that's the interesting thing about it. I mean, not only has she not been investigated, and we know this because Russell wasn't allowed near her because, you know, he kept trying to do things and they kept blocking him at different points. Now, Russell was the one who actually, the first time he met Sharitha, I think it was the first time, first or second, he was the one who had to give her the notification that Kevin Gaines, her boyfriend, had been killed. And Russ Poole said flat out, she didn't even show one sign of grief about it. And that's not, I mean, that's not damning. I don't want to make it sound like, you know, that there it is, because, you know, people grieve in different ways. I mean, maybe she was all cried out already. I don't know. But at the end of the day, Russell's, you know, had involvement with her. Now, I would say within 3 days or 4 days after the shooting happened, Sharitha was on the phone with the LAPD trying to get her car back because Kevin Gaines was killed in her truck. And she, within days, she was already calling wanting her truck back. Now, if you ask me, that's a very strange way of grieving. I think the truck would probably be the last thing I'd be worried about if my girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever had gotten killed. You know, getting back that truck would be the last thing. And, of course, the LAPD released the truck back to her, and Russ was pissed off because they had found traces of drugs in the car, and they were going to follow up on that. But because she got that car out of impound so fast, they never had a chance to finish all the testing that they wanted to get done. And so, you know, there was a lot more to meets the eye there. But other than that, Sharitha Knight has never been talked to because largely, number one, you got to put this in perspective too. Sharitha Knight and going after Suge, you know, if you're talking about the Vegas incident, you know, that really is Las Vegas Police Department's jurisdiction. That they're really the ones who are the ones doing the, you know, the investigation. They're the ones who are doing it. And so they can choose to talk to her. They can choose not to talk to her. LAPD can't make them talk to her. But as things started to tighten up regarding the LAPD and Kevin Gaines and all that, she should have been talked to, and she wasn't. And it wasn't until people started understanding the kind of complex relationship that she had with Suge, where it was all about money. I mean, there was no love there. They were cheating on each other constantly. You know, there was no love about it. It was all business. And so when you look at somebody who says, okay, it's all about business, legally she already owned half of Death Row under California community property. She owned half of what Suge had in Death Row. Suge and Kenner had half of Death Row each. So Suge's half, she get half of that. She owned 25% of Death Row without even thinking about it. Okay? Now, are we saying that she put the gun in somebody's hand and said, run out and kill him? No, we're not saying that at all. But we have to look at motive, and that's really what it comes down to, means, motive, and opportunity. If somebody's going to be involved with something, do they have the means to do it? Do they have the motive to do it? Well, if you got a spouse that's cheating on you, and there's no love there anymore. And she even said that in, I think it was National Geographic did a show where she said, you know, Suge messed up and Suge wasn't the same anymore. And you know, they fell out of love and however she wants to put it. She already owned half of Death Row. Somebody comes to her and says, hey, would you have any problem taking this guy out? What's she going to say? Yeah, sure. Why not? What does she care? You know, he's a cheating husband. I mean, you know, that's why Gordon Martinez with the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, any investigation you do that involves a murder of somebody, you know, the first person they look at is but I think in this case, because he wasn't killed, it didn't readily just jump on everybody's radar to start looking in that direction. He wasn't killed. It'd have been a different story if he had been killed, because then they would have been following the playbook, and who's the first person you look at? You look at the spouse, right? So I think that's really what it comes down to for us, is to say, all right, well, you know, here's another person that has means, motive, and opportunity to see this guy gone, and, you know, and would benefit from it if he did. And that's why you have to put her up on the board, because when you look at, you know, you've seen it on TV where they put the whiteboard up and they put the pictures all up there about everybody that's involved, you know. We have to figure out how they're involved, but we know that they are because they have means, motive, and opportunity. They got a reason to gain from it.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely.
I mean, well, you know, when the LAPD says when the FBI says that the LAPD, or it was the LAPD Internal Affairs that said that Kevin Gaines was on a special assignment in Las Vegas the night that Tupac got shot. Well, what the hell does that mean?
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Know, that's the thing. Well, there's a lot of questions. That.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Well, you know, other documentaries, they flat out named who they believe were the shooters were. Do you care to name who you think the shooter is?
Well, I think that if you believe the confession letter, and there's a lot of good reasons to, and the problem is people have just too quickly dismissed the confession letter for a lot of really bad reasons. Because, you know, you think about it, the guy who wrote the confession letter, Sorry, I shouldn't say wrote it. The guy who was the guy that delivered it, Robert Soria, the guy that's in prison now. You know, he's the one who delivered it. Danny and Malcolm Patton. Danny Patton's the one that dictated the letter to Soria's sister. And because he didn't want to write it himself, he didn't want it in his own handwriting. So he dictates a letter. She writes it. Soria takes it to Chris Blatchford at Fox News, gives it to him because the Pattons didn't want to show up for an interview. They chickened out of an interview. An on-camera one, in fact, where they were going to admit it on camera. But in that letter, it speaks to, and then, of course, a statement, and I actually emailed you a copy of the statement that was given to us, so you'd have it. Chris Blatchford, I mean, they were told flat out that Danny Patton, Malcolm Patton, and Lil Half Dead were the three that were in the car, okay? And that there were shooters, and there was a driver. And, you know, that's what the letter says. Now, you go in and you look at the letter and you say, okay, you know, who are all these people? Well, I emailed you and you can, you know, put it up if you want to put it up on your, you know, on your YouTube or to show it or whatever the case might be. I sent you a copy of Yahoo Fula's statement to the Los Angeles Police or Las Vegas Police Department that has a description of the driver. Yakfula was the one who was the closest to the vehicle that was the shooter's, and he gave a description to the Las Vegas Police Department about what the driver of the car looked like. He never said he saw the shooter, but he saw the driver. And if you look at the picture of his explanation of what Yakfula says is the driver, and you look at the picture of Danny Patton, you draw your own conclusions, okay? But you can't deny that there's a passing resemblance between that person and the description that Yakfula gave Las Vegas police. You just can't. You can't get past it. And, yeah, they could say, well, sure, it could be anybody. But, I mean, when you think about it, what are the odds when you go back and you look at probabilities and you look at, like, let's say you're a Vegas odds maker. What are the odds that some gang guy or some paranoid schizophrenic, I think Greg Kading called Soria paranoid schizophrenic, and it was all made up. Who would know that Little Half Dead got traded to Priority Records from Death Row Records? What gang person would know that? How would they know anything about the record industry? How would they know how important that was and how significant it was that a member of the Dog Pound got shuttled away from Death Row Records and got sent down to Priority Records, which was at the time kind of like the second-class citizen, okay? Whereas Shook could make money off them, but Priority wasn't Death Row. You understand what I mean? Are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me, RJ?
Yeah, I just want to make sure I didn't lose you. I got
yeah, when
rant,
you throw
so.
Little Half Dead in the mix, that goes back to the beginning of the interview when we was talking about the Snoop Pac beef. Do you think there was anything that was going on there with Little Half Dead? I mean, he was a Crip, but then a lot of the police officers were Bloods.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean,
sure,
there's tension between the Bloods and the Crips at the label, but. You know, according to this, the Crips are the ones who killed Pac then.
Well, it's a very interesting thing that you point out because according to the letter, they were going to – the Pyrus themselves were going to take out Suge. Okay, that was already a given. The Pyrus, the Bloods themselves are going to take out Suge. And you think to yourself, why would they do that? Well, I mean, if you've watched any mob movie or you watch any, you know, Goodfellas or you watch anything like that, I mean, all these wise guys, they get clipped by their own people constantly, okay? And it's the guys that they think are their friends. They turn around and they say, hey, good to see you. Bang, they get shot in the head, okay? I mean, this is not unusual. This is nothing new. But the thing about it, and this is what we believe, and of course, like I said, you know, Suge has pretty well endorsed what we have to say at this point. And what we have to say is that we believe Suge knew who the driver was. He saw the shooter, knew who the shooters were. He knew that they were Pyrus. He knew that they were his own group, people that he knew. So what does that tell you? If you look at the face of somebody who's from your own crew and they're the ones shooting at you, who's your friend at that point? No one. No one's your friend. Who are you going to snitch on? Who are you going to retaliate against? Your own people?
Yeah.
So you're kind of in a screwed, you're kind of in a screwed position to begin with. So they had that. Now, according to the letter, Little Half Dead had just been kind of badly dealt with by Tupac, according to the letter. And everybody laughs. The whole Brenda's got a baby, and I want to just talk about that for a second because it's so important that we get that out. Everybody laughs and says, "Oh, you know, Pac wrote Brenda's got a baby. This is stupid. This letter is stupid. Ha ha." He says Lil Half Dead wrote Brenda's Got a Baby. Well, that's just stupid because Lil Half Dead could never have written Brenda's Got a Baby. Pac wrote Brenda's Got a Baby. I was there. I saw Pac write it. Okay. Got it. Make sense? Absolutely. Here's the deal with that. You can't just laugh it off. And you can't just write it off, and I'll tell you why. Because if Lil Half Dead, for whatever reason, thought that Pac had taken a song of his and made it into Brenda's Got a Baby, it doesn't mean that Pac didn't write the song. Pac could have written the whole song all by himself. But if Little Half Dead just gets it in his mind that Pac ripped him off, and you know how people are. I mean, there's people all the time see something and say, "Oh, yeah, they took my idea." Okay, maybe they didn't, but maybe you think they did. And so if that's your perception, if that's your reality, if that's what you're telling other people, okay, whether or not even that's bullshit, he may have been just bullshitting somebody and just trying to take claim for something that, you know, wasn't true. Maybe he was just bullshitting. But what we're getting at here is that no matter what, either it was complete bullshit or maybe he really believed at the time that Pac had ripped him off. It doesn't mean that Pac ripped him off, and it doesn't mean that Pac didn't write Brenda's Got a Baby. What it means is exactly that, that Little Half Dead, for whatever reason, at that time, thought he got ripped off. He thought that Pac was ripping him off with Brenda's Got a Baby. So I don't know how people can just dismiss the letter out and say, "Oh, it's a joke because Pac never wrote Brenda. Pac wrote Brenda's Got a Baby. Little Half Dead never wrote that." Well, that could be true, but that doesn't mean that Little Half Dead didn't feel like he had been ripped off. You understand what I'm saying? How many beefs? How many killings? How many beefs? How many beatings have happened over somebody's bad perception?
Yeah.
Believes something that's not true. It's not true, but you can't convince them that it's not true. They just believe it for whatever reason. I mean, entire civilizations have gone to war over bad perception. I wouldn't be so quick to sit there and look at that letter and say, "Oh, well, Little Half Dead said Pac wrote Brenda's Got a Baby." Well, that's just stupid. Well, not if it's his perception. Okay, the letter doesn't say that. In fact, Little Half Dead did write Brenda's Got a Baby, and Tupac ripped it off. That's not what the letter says. The letter says that there was a problem with demo stealing, which we know is true, and it also mentions that Little Half Dead felt like he had been ripped off by Tupac. So I'm not here to put, you know, you and I can't think for Little Half Dead. We can't put thoughts in his mind. We can't say what he did or what he didn't think. We can't do that. All we can do is go off of what it says. And if it makes any kind of sense at all, like the demo stealing, if it makes any kind of sense at all that Little Half Dead may have believed at the time that he'd been ripped off, he's going to confront Pac about it. And that leads to the beatings. Did he get beat up? Well, it was pretty common practice for Pac to beat up people in a garden. I would say he didn't beat him up. He usually throw the first sucker punch, and then the rest of the gang would come in and finish the job for him. But, you know, Atron, there's so many people, Shock G, that would talk about Pac just getting into fights for no reason. He would just start a fight for no apparent reason. So for them to say that Little Half Dead challenged Pac about something, it doesn't say, funny enough, in the letter, again, this is from 1998, it doesn't say that Pac was beat up by – I mean, I'm sorry, that Little Half Dead was beat up by Pac. It doesn't say that at all. It says that Little Half Dead was beat up by Pac soldiers. Now, if you know anything about Pac, and most of the people I've talked to do, that's how it always went. And, in fact, that's how it went at the MGM, didn't it?
Yeah.
Pac, Pac threw that first punch, and everybody else jumped in after that. In fact, Frank had drugged Pac away by the time Buntry got in there. Pac was already out of the fight. So,
yeah,
when you look at Pac, yeah, when
you
look at how this
see him run, walking out with him real fast.
So now, so think about this for a minute. Now you think about it. You go back to the letter that was written in 1998. Nobody's seen it since that day, all right? And you put that in there, and you look at that Tupac got beat up by half-dead soldiers. What kind of gang guy would make that up and not understand the significance of what that meant? I mean, what, are you just throwing a dart at a dartboard? You're just making some shit up that just happens to be historically accurate with everything else that the guy's done? I mean, how well do you know Tupac at that point? These guys didn't know Tupac at all. Patton's didn't know him at all. When you look at the details that are in this letter, you look at the things that were done and the historical precedent of it, how could you sit there and say that there's not some level of accuracy or legitimacy to it? Because who'd make this up?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you get that close?
Sounds very, very fishy. I mean, there's a lot of... a lot of things leading to the LAPD. I mean, there's things leading, Suge's wife's direction. I mean, it's like a spider web. And if you notice too, RJ, which well, of course you notice, you put a lot of this together. It's almost like the movie Goodfellas after the LaFanza heist. People just start ending up getting killed everywhere.
Well, you know that's a cleanup.
Yeah. Can we, before we go, I'm going to take a couple more calls, but before
absolutely,
I do,
sure.
Let's talk about, like, all the people that, you know, were either killed or died mysteriously after all this.
Okay.
Would Gaddafi be the first?
Right. You know, they went back, the FBI went back and they re-interviewed the detectives that originally worked his murder case, and the FBI was told by those detectives flat out that it wasn't an accident, that Gaddafi was killed mob style. He was shot in the eye execution style. This was not just goofing around with a gun, and a gun went off, and it was an accident, and how terrible it was. He was shot execution style. The FBI has already documented that. That's what the detectives told the FBI. So how in the world can that not be intentional? You know, you don't just accidentally shoot yourself in the eye.
Exactly. And this is, I mean, we just spoke about, too, about the testimony. You know, he said that he couldn't identify the shooter, but he more than likely could identify the driver.
Yep. I mean, he was the only one, other than Suge, maybe, he was the only one that was willing to give a description and the only one. Now, if you look at the people just coincidentally that are mentioned in the confession letter, I mean, the confession letter could have mentioned anybody. Could have mentioned anybody's name, pull a name out of a hat. But it just so happens that one of the names mentioned in the confession letter also happens to match the description given by the only guy who actually saw what happened. And then you find out that the only guy who saw what happened is dead. Well, there you go. It kind of makes, you know, kind of wraps itself up, doesn't it?
Well, it looks definitely like there needs to be a lot of things discussed, another investigation, but something outside, you know, because it can't be internal from the LAPD. And like you point out in the documentary too, Vegas, they pretty much had their hands tied because they were, you know, they had to pretty much do whatever LAPD or Compton PD told them. Now, the war for Compton, that's the whole title, you know what I'm saying, behind this. How much of a role did Compton play in you know, the Compton PD, the mayor? I mean, there was ties with the mayor.
Well,
can you speak on that a little bit?
Sure. You know, the big thing that Battle for Compton brings out is the fact that, you know, you have to have, you know, we talk about these things all the time. You hear, oh, death row is being investigated for money laundering. Well, you hear that term a lot, but most people don't know what the hell that means. What is money laundering? What does that look like? What if I had to see somebody doing something and say, oh, that's money laundering? Nobody really understands what that is. You hear the term, but you just, you know, you don't see it in everyday life. You know, oh, those guys are over there money laundering. Okay. You don't see it. So what the movie tried to do was to open it up and say, okay, let's look at what money laundering looks like. And what let's look at what happened with the flow of drugs and the drugs coming out of the Compton evidence locker and the malfeasance that went on. I mean, when you have an entire police department that gets shut down for corruption, you know, there's a, let me talk about in the movie, there's a lot of options there. You could fire the chief, you could restructure the department, you could, there's a lot of things you could do. It's a last resort to completely dismantle the police department. So you got to know there was some serious bad shit going on. And so we did is go, okay, so we get that. We understand that. But it's not enough just to say there was some bad shit going on. Why were they disbanded? What made it so bad? Well, fortunately, you know, we got the documents and the evidence that we received that really backs that story and gives us a pretty, I would hope you would agree, gives you a pretty good understanding of exactly how bad the corruption went, both at the city of Compton and, you know, and at the Compton Police Department. So when you have that Compton Police Department, city Compton corruption, and Omar Bradley says there's no difference between death row records in the city of Compton, and you get where he's given the description of whose people in positions of power in Compton had relatives working for death row records, you know, you just – understand this is money laundering. You know, when 147 gallons of PCP goes missing out of an evidence locker, that's crazy. Do you see the street value on that? That's crazy.
I remember back in the day in Chicago, wiki sticks were about $10 a pop. So
So you're talking 142 gallons. You know, that's crazy. It's huge. So when you look at that, I mean, and it's no question about it. We know that, you know, they had to back up a big rig to pull out all the guns that were, you know, booked into evidence, you know, taken off of suspects in a robbery. Somehow they found their way out of the Compton PD's evidence locker and to the right out to the gun store where they got sold again. You know, that's the crazy part about all this. I mean, the malfeasance and the corruption was just so big. And death row was right there with him, right in the middle of all of it with him. And that was the operation. That was what was worth protecting. And how do you know that? I mean, we didn't touch about it a lot in the movie, but when Mayor Bradley got, you know, basically lost his bid for election to Eric Paradin, the first thing on Eric Paradin's agenda was getting that Compton Police Department back running again after it had been disbanded. Why? L.A. Sheriffs were doing a fine job with it, and all the cops like Tim Brennan already had jobs. They were given jobs at the L.A. County Sheriff's Department. And you think as a cop, well, I got a small-town police department, so I have limited resources, or I have a whole county sheriff's department, and now I got all the resources I need to do my job. How much better job could I do? But no, these guys actually file a lawsuit against the city of Compton, violating their civil rights, wanting to get the judge – to put the Compton Police Department back together again. And you got to ask yourself why. And then when they lose that court case and the judge says, I ain't putting that Compton Police Department's corrupt as hell. I ain't putting that back together again. And he turns them down. They appeal it to federal court. Now that's a lot of fighting you're doing for a police department that ain't worth a damn. But then when when that new mayor gets in there, what's that first thing he want to do? Put that Compton Police Department back together. Let's get the band back again.
Well,
that crazy?
It's definitely, I mean, you know, with all these cops involved and different things, before I bring on these callers, I want to ask you this one last question, RJ. You're turning over a lot of stones. You're becoming a thorn in the side of many people. So are we for even interviewing certain guests. But who gives a fuck? We're going to keep doing it. Are you in fear of your life? Have you ever been in situations when you were told to shut up or something's going to happen to you?
Well, if that were the case, I'd have been done 10 years ago. You know, I've been doing this for 10 years now. And there was one time, and I'll never forget it. There was one time, and I'll keep this story short, but it's a good one. Frank Alexander and I went to the Magic Show. It's a fashion show in Las Vegas, Nevada. This was in 2009. And I went along with him because I'm his buddy. He was working security for one of the retailers at the show. And he was double armed. He had a hidden sidearm, and he had another gun in his ankle. And he was there doing, you know, bodyguard work. And I went along just for the ride because I like going to Vegas, and Frank's a good buddy of mine, and we hung out. Well, while we're standing there, a guy comes up and runs up to Frank and whispers something in Frank's ear, and Frank turns death stone cold killer. Like, I've never seen him look before. He looked like he was going to kill somebody. And I said, "What's going on?" And he said, "Suge Knight's in the next row over from us." Okay, now at this time, this is Frank Alexander versus Suge Knight. This is Assassination One, where we kind of threw a lot of rocks that way in Suge's area. So Suge's going to be coming over, and what's that going to look like? Because when Suge comes down that aisle, what's going to happen? And I looked at Frank Alexander, and I swear to you, this is what he said. He said, "If that man comes near me and breathes one word, I will shoot him dead right now. I am ready to die. I will shoot him dead." Well, the good news was, of course, my response to that was, "Well, if you're going to do that, let me go grab my camera." So, you know. So I said that is true. That's what I told him. But Suge went to the other aisle. He did not turn down our aisle. We don't know whether that was because somebody told him or whether or not it was because it just, you know, luck of the draw. But he went the other way, and that situation diffused itself. But, I mean, I've been in these situations that are just, you know, tense as hell. And, you know, yeah, it gives me pause for concern. And, my wife and my family, you know, they didn't sign up for this. You know, but, you know, if that was going to be the case, I'd have been out of it a long time ago. And, you know, you got to realize that a lot of these guys that are in the middle of this now, they're not in power anymore. They don't have the same kind of juice they used to have. You know, they're you know, retired, or they're worrying about their pension now. They're worrying about, you know, playing on their boat and doing those things. Because the allegations that we're making, the reality of it, it's probably part of the frustrating part about the movie, is that, you know, until the official narrative gets knocked down, until this whole noise about Orlando Anderson, this nonsense about that goes away, it doesn't matter what other alternative theory you have, nobody's going to take it seriously. And that's kind of the frustrating part, and for that reason, it's something that we're not really a threat to these guys. We can stamp our ground and yell and jump up and down all day, but we're not really a threat to these guys until that other narrative goes away. When that other narrative goes away, now people have some exposure and maybe some liability. That might be a different story. But for right now, you know, we're just another wackadoo theory out there.
Yeah, unfortunately. And, you know, it's crazy because here we are 20-plus years later, just come up on the 20th anniversary of Big's death, and there's people walking around that had something to do with both of their homicides, and that's the crazy part. But I got a couple of callers for you, RJ.
Great.
This one, I believe. Okay, this is the homie Exit Only, Jackson, Mississippi, one of Jackson, Mississippi's dopest artists. How you doing, Exit?
Oh, I'm good, Brez. I'm good. What's going on?
Listen to this interview, man. It's just crazy. What do you think?
Man, wow. I kind of like, I got questions, but really don't want to ask them, if you know what I'm talking about, because I've heard so many different theories with this whole thing. But I'm going to have to ask you this, brother. I'm going to have to, because I'm really trying to, well, I put it this way. We came up in the era when this actually emerged. I'm really a pop fan. I can actually sit there and say this. I'm a grand fan of hip hop. I done watched this thing with him, this situation with Biggie.
Yeah.
I think the first actual footage I saw was with Frank, and he entired the police department within it. Then I heard the theory about Orlando, Puffy being behind hiring the guy to actually create all this. There's so many different avenues to this, like, you know what I'm saying? It's crazy. But
it is.
You said something interesting tonight when you mentioned Gaddafi and him being taken out. and how the mob function with things, which is what most gangs kind of base their whole structure around. You know, it's a different level of the mob, but they still have that family structure. They still have that revenge structure. They still have that no disrespect in the family structure. So
yeah.
It's right. A lot of things you said that kind of got me. This is what I want to know. And I guess I can ask you this. I mean, hell, this is the Murder Master Music Show. I feel like I can ask anything. I hope you don't take nothing the wrong way. Wasn't Gaddafi a Crip?
He was. He was.
That's what I thought.
He was in New Jersey Crip.
And what you're basically saying is, we already know that there's gang members even in the police department. We know this. Hell, it's
right.
Like that here. You know what I'm saying? So to sit there and say that this officer was behind and he tied in with Pyru, that's not far-fetched.
Well, let me tell you this. You've got to see the movie. Get your hands on the movie however you are, because we explain exactly how that's all connected, how Gaddafi and his relationship and what happened, according to LAPD records, what happened shortly before Gaddafi got killed. And I think it'll blow your mind. I don't want to give it away, but the answer, a lot of what you're asking right there is valid, good, and I would say you got to see the movie because it's going to give it up for you.
Man, shoot All prayers, right. Whatever information, a link that I need, and he know how to get it to me, because I honestly want to see it from beginning to end. I done watched every theory that done popped up. I think I done seen them all. But out of all these years, I feel like we really kind of deserve the truth. Hey, shit can be done about it now. It's not going to bring them back.
Yeah, I don't think that we're going to get a conviction, but if we can get the truth, I think that's what matters. You know,
yeah,
at the end of the day.
Spears already in jail. Everybody else have failed for power. Statute of limitations. But I think we deserve the truth.
Yeah, I agree. That's what we're out trying to
do,
man. We're beating all the bushes we can to try to get that, to figure out what that is.
Yeah.
But I thank you for being on the show. I thank you for, you know, bringing this forth. I thank you. And like I say, shoot prayers the link, and he'll get everything to me because I most definitely want to see this footage.
Well,
I look forward to hearing
what you think.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you so much, man. I actually checked it out. I looked on Amazon to make sure when the release date was. I believe it came out the 10th, right, RJ?
That's right, yep.
I looked at one
okay.
of the first review on there is the son of Russell Poole, who saw the flick. So, yeah, man, it's definitely it's worth checking out for sure. Thanks for calling in, actually. I got one more for you, RJ. I know we kept you a long time tonight. I really appreciate you.
I appreciate
it. The homie.
That's great. Thank you.
Out
and
of
you
France.
Know what? We'll do this again. Yeah, we'll do this again after people have had a chance to see the movie. Let's do it again. Let's get some questions up and get some people that got some, you know, questions. And we'll just do a straight Q&A, man. Well, you know, if people got questions, we'll just do that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, well, hopefully after this interview, there's enough information we gave them to make them want to see the movie. Again, it's called
Assassin
Battle for Compton. Oh, yeah, definitely, man. It's a hell of a flick. Sin from France, how you doing? This is the French Connection. How you doing,
Sin? Yeah, I'm fine. I've got on a high with AG. But can you say how many cops who could be involved into Blood Gang and actually get to death row? And there is a connection with cops involved into Crip Gang and could be involved into Tupac assassination.
Yeah, he basically was saying about the Blood Gang, you know, being involved with the police. Do you believe that there was also Crip gang members in the cops who had involvement in the assassination with Tupac? Or do you think it was just Bloods?
Yeah, well, according to Omar Bradley, and I don't profess to be an expert on you know, police gang affiliations, but according to Omar Bradley, who I think would, most of the cops were of Crip sets. Most of them were. And, you know, there may have been some Bloods in there as well, but most of them were Compton Crips, especially on the Compton PD, were Compton Crips. You know, there's always been that thought. I can't speak to that directly, but I'll say one thing. That's a great question, but I will say that there's one thought that's been put on me constantly, and that's leveled from another filmmaker or documentary guy or whatever you want to call him, author, that, you know, he says, well, R.J. Bond is putting out this theory that involves hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people in this grand conspiracy, and all these people had to know about it, and nobody ever said anything because all these people knew about it. All these people know about that, you know. And have you've heard that before? Because I think he even said that on your show, that Kading said that you know, for my theory to work, all these hundreds and thousands of people would have to be involved, and it gets bigger and bigger, and now you're tying entire police departments in, and everybody would have to know what's going on. But you know what? That's not true. It's not true. If I take a document, let's say I take a document that I know is bogus, and I take it to the city clerk's office, and I ask her to put a stamp on it and file it away for me, and I do that, and it's a bogus document, and that city clerk stamps it, and she puts it in the file. Okay, well, is she part of my conspiracy because I did something wrong? No. She just does her job. She does what she's supposed to do. There's a lot of hardworking men and women on the police departments that didn't know anything about what was going on. But that doesn't mean that, like we learned with the Compton Police Department, it doesn't mean that any of them were necessarily telling them to keep the door shut on the evidence locker. They all knew that you could get in and out of that evidence locker all day, and that there was no real, you know, you could get into it anytime you wanted to, and there was no real safeguards on that evidence locker. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're complicit and that they're bad or that they're evil or that they're part of this conspiracy. No, they just were around at the time that it happened. And just like that clerk that took my bad document and filed it away, they may not even have any idea that this stuff, this malfeasance is happening, but the people at the top do. And that's why I thought it was so important for Gordon Martinez to say, if police corruption is going to exist in a police department, it has to be approved from the top down. It has to be.
Yeah, definitely. It's got corruption written all over it, betrayal, sabotage. It's just crazy, man. It really is. But I tell you what, RJ, this was a hell of a documentary.
Thank you.
Tupac Assassination, Battle for Compton, available right now. You know what I'm saying? Thank you for coming on the show.
We've interviewed, definitely.
And as you know, we've interviewed other people have other theories about the assassinations and stuff.
Yeah.
We wouldn't be doing our listeners justice if we didn't interview everybody. So I want to thank you for agreeing to come on the show. Hell of an interview. And you're welcome on anytime. Love to have you back again, like you said. We're gonna leave here, man. Tupac, holler at me.
Niggas out there jealous, cause we be failing with that role. They try to play a hang, but they can't fade us though. We be mobbing through the neighborhood, yeah, with that funk sound.
Out to you, Claire. You know who you are. Gotta be careful, can't let the evil of the money trap me. So when you see me, nigga, you better holler at me. Gotta be careful, can't let the evil of the money trap me. So when you see me, nigga, you better holler at me. Walking out inside the shoes of a nigga who don't have a thing to lose. I mean, you knew was on me. No one before me, it was all a scheme. You infiltrated my team.
can never be friends. I know I'm running through your head now. What could you do if it was up to you? I'd be dead now. I let the world know, nigga, you a coward. You can never be live until you die. See the motherfucking bitch in your eyes. Type of nigga, let the evil of the money trap me. When you see me, nigga, you better holler at me. Call it back. Don't let the evil of the money trap me. So when you see me, nigga, you better holler at me. I'm addicted to currency, nigga, that's why we doing this. Got set up, I surprised the niggas the way I got up. And then I hit the studio, it's time to blow the block up. No hesitation, this information got you contemplating. Heartbreaking, eliminating with the conversation. Break them and let them see the face of a middle patient. A celebration, I'm a criminal elevation. More participation, I want members across the 50 states. We keep the nation anticipating until we break. Will I be great, is it my fate? To live a life of luxury, so niggas on my day. So let's tell us this, yeah. So be prepared, cause only the strong survive. Life isn't fair. Probably never knew the way it feels to die. So you figure fuck with me, I get that ass to try. Nigga, holla. Gotta be careful, can't let the evil of the money trap me. So when you see me, nigga, you better holla at me.
You better be where you stay. We better not find where you stay.
And now I gotta be careful, can't let the evil of the money trap me. So when you see me, nigga, you better holla at me. Young black brother doing time. So many brothers' brains in this early game. It's the same, so much pressure on my brain. Why she blame me? Secrets in the dark, only her and I know. Now I'm sitting in the safe can, doing time slow. Cause she made a bad decision that got me living. Just like an animal, I'm caged up in state prison. My nigga visit, cause hell has a fury like a woman scorn. A cemetery full of motherfuckers not knowing. Picture my prophecy, I got some attacking me on top of me. I'm running from the cops, but never let them stop me, cause I'm a soldier. Ever since I was a little nigga, having fantasies of one day being old. Trust a no-no. Love is a mystery. Fuck the po-po. Holla at me. So when you see me, nigga, you better holla at me.
You better be where will you lay. We better not find where you stay.
Gotta be careful, can't let the evil of the money trap me. So when you see me, nigga, you better holla at me.
You better be where will you lay. We better not find where you stay.
Gotta be careful, can't let the evil of the money trap me.
And find where you stay.
Niggas, something jealous, cause we be failing with this road. They try to play a hate, but they can't fade us though. We be mobbing through the neighborhood, yeah. With that funky sound,
yeah.
We be throwing down.
Gotta be careful, can't let the evil of the money trap me. So when you see me, nigga, you better holler at me.
Trap.